Greetings, my friend, and welcome to Beyond Curious. Conversations with brave adventurers like yourself that are taking voyages into the unknown to satisfy their curiosity, fulfill their purpose, and bring their ideas to life. My name is Brandon Fong, and I'm so excited to have you here. Whether you are a new friend or an old friend, you guys are in for a treat because today's guest is Lloyd Lobo.
I would just go back to India, and my childhood summer vacations every year were spent in the slums of Mumbai. And there's no toilet. So you got to line up, right, every day to go to the toilet, right? There's no water tank there, so you got to pump water, stand in line a couple times a day. It would rain every summer, so the puddles would turn into ponds and people would be swimming together. Everything from like going to the bathroom to pumping water to eating food to watching TV is a communal activity. And that was like my fondest childhood summers were spent there. Every summer when we had to go back to Kuwait, I'd grab my parents by the feet and cry. I didn't want to leave. And that just tells you the power of people in coming together, doing things together.
If you couldn't already tell from that quote, this story is the epitome of an underdog story. Talk about an amazing, amazing story and an amazing human that has accomplished some good in the world through being somebody that is just passionate about creating community and connection. So I'm super excited to tell you all about Lloyd. So let me tell you about his bio. Lloyd Lobo, an entrepreneur, podcast host, and community builder, experienced the Gulf War as a young refugee in Kuwait, witnessing the strength of community in evacuating the population to safety. As the co-founder of fintech platform Boast.ai, he leveraged the community-led growth model to bootstrap the company to $10 million in annual recurring revenue, while also co-founding Traction, a community empowering more than 100,000 innovators through connections, content, and capital. Lloyd is also the author of the Wall Street Journal best-selling book, From Grassroots to Greatness, 13 Rules to Build Iconic Brands with Community-Led Growth, which covers tactical advice from community-led business, both big and small, such as Apple, Harley Davidson, Nike, CrossFit, HubSpot, and many more, to help readers attract passionate and devoted fans of their own. Lloyd has been covered in Fox Business, TechCrunch, SF Business Journals, Forbes, and several other publications. He has also been a speaker at more than 100 conferences and podcasts, including Saster, Entrepreneurs on Fire, Marketing School, Mixergy, and more. Guys, there is so much to look forward to in today's episode, but as always, I want you to look out for three specific things. Number one, what community-led growth is and how Lloyd leveraged it to bootstrap his company to $10 million a year. Number two, how you can build more effective communities leveraging insights like Lloyd's Camper framework, that's C-A-M-P-E-R, super good. And number three, how Lloyd and his family actually escaped the Gulf War when he was 8 years old and what he learned about community as a young refugee. Guys, I am so excited for you to listen to this episode, and I'm so excited to study Lloyd's work at an even deeper level after having done this interview, as I look forward for myself and my business as I grow my mastermind called Curiosity Island. I've realized more and more that building a community around this, not only for the mastermind itself, but for outside of the mastermind, it is going to be critical in my success. So I'm super excited to introduce you to a community builder that has opened my eyes as to what is possible when it comes to creating a more deeply connected world through community, Lloyd Lobo. Mr. Lloyd Lobo, my friend, so excited to have you here. This is going to be a wide-ranging, heart-pumping conversation. So excited to have you here, brother.
Super stoked to be here. It's funny how like a couple conversations around the same time led us to each other.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. You know, when I have people that are like, do you know Lloyd? And then 2 weeks later, someone's like, do you know Lloyd? It's like, okay, got to talk to this guy. So I love the first time we chatted. Super excited to have gone through your content and your book and all things community. But as always, I love to start with a story because I think people really need to know about who you are and where you came from. And I can't help but ask about this epic story you open your book with. So you're 8 years old. You studied for the wrong test in school. Talk to us about what happens from there.
You know, it's funny, and I think sticks with me till today, is I procrastinate on stuff, on shit that I'm not into, right? And one of them is like reading, right? I just hate reading. I read just in time. Now, like the way I consume content, meaning reading stuff, is I take on a project, I need to apply that, I read it just in time, or like I'll reference stuff. And I think the best way to learn is that way, right? When you immediately apply it. But growing up, man, I hated reading, studying. Like, it wasn't my jam. And so I'd study last minute, like everything. Until today, the things that I just absolutely dislike, I procrastinate till the end, right? One of them is like taxes, for example. But, but all of us. But nonetheless, I procrastinate the crap out of this exams every time as a kid. And then I study for a math exam. I show up. It's a geography exam. I'm like, crap, man. Fourth grader, right? I think I was nine. Yeah, fourth grader, I think I'm going to fail. This is done. And I'm like trying to cheat. Imagine you're this little kid trying to peek into people's sheets, trying to cheat. And like, oh, man. I didn't even know what cheating was, but I knew that I need to look for a solution. It was just like stress and dread in my face. And then summer rolls around. All summer, I'm super stressed. And then end of the summer, my mom wakes me up and she's like, hey, I don't think you can go back to school. War has broken out. I didn't even know what war was really, right? And my first reaction was, yes, you're never going to find out because I study for the math exam. It's geography exam. And like geography is like, it's a lot of memorization at that age, right? You're trying to remember stuff that I'm like, I didn't even study for it. So I'm like, yes, you're never going to find out that I failed, but, and you know, failed the grade. But nonetheless, worry started to sink in on their faces and the reality started to sink in for me. I'm like, okay, this is serious, right? This is a serious situation. And that day when I went down the building with my dad, I saw a bunch of worried faces. Now, what happens in 2024 is a lot of us, right, just belabor on the problem, right? And this is exacerbated by social media. Good news never spreads, right? It spreads, but like, you know, nobody doesn't fester and turn into new monsters or new things. But bad news just perpetuates and perpetuates. And I think social media websites, starting with news sites, have figured out that people stay more engaged on negativity, negative news, right? But back then, none of this was around, right? Like social media wasn't around. Internet wasn't a thing. Cell phones didn't exist. So people were coming together to solve it, right? Someone's like, hey, I'll guard the building from X to Y time and I'll coordinate food supplies. And if you've got family members that are displaced, I can give them shelter. So every building became a sub-community that coordinated with the next building, and coordinated with embassies and governments and evacuated us to safety because the security in the country had lapsed. And literally, it was a large, I would say one of the largest grassroots movements that organically came together to evacuate the people of the country to safety.
That's crazy. And I can't even imagine like the comprehension and the reality of just growing up so fast in a war zone, what that did to you and just the way that you had to learn about how to connect and read social situations and coordinate with people. I just can't even imagine. So I know part of this story too, that was just transformational for you is eventually they did evacuate you guys and you had an opportunity to escape, but you had to go down Highway 80, which was known as the Highway of Death. So maybe if you could just paint the scene for us, like take us there. Like we're in the bus. What are we seeing outside of the windows? What's going on? How are you feeling? How are your parents feeling? Take us right there. Cause I think this is so powerful.
I think that journey reflecting back was probably one of the most pivotal parts of my life. Right. And as a kid, I'm on this freaking rickety bus and we're going on this highway of death. Buses alongside are bombed. You're hearing whispers of like, you know, people are getting killed. Everything is just shattered and blown up. And you don't know when you're going to reach, when you're going to land, where you're going to go, if you're going to be alive or dead, right? On top of that, you've lost your home. Currency is invalid. You don't know what's going to happen. And the funny thing is, as we went on this multi-day journey from Kuwait to Baghdad to Jordan and then in the Jordan Amman camp, refugee camp, and then eventually we were evacuated out of there to India was the first destination we went to from there. And the people around the bus, as I looked around, the adults were, should have been crying, right? Should have been sad, should have been worried. But they were laughing and singing and playing the guitar, listening to Bollywood music. My parents from India, and like this, so the community, sub-community, predominantly Indian on that bus. And as I reflect back, I realize that, you know, we often say it's the destination, or we say, no, it's the journey. And I say, it's neither. It's neither the destination or the journey. It's the companions that matter the most. You could be on a shitty journey on the way to hell, but great companions will make it memorable. Now, let me ask you, Brendan, like, you've probably been in situations where, like, you know, you're in this exquisite environment, but you just want to get the hell out of there. Maybe like you're sipping champagne in a chateau somewhere, but just the toxicity of the people wants to make you leave. Have you experienced such things?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like a specific thing. I know the feeling of feeling like you should be happy, but something's missing. So I can resonate with that, but I might take a second to kind of think of a specific moment.
Yeah, definitely. And then you'll be in situations where it's just like you're on a bus going through a war zone, but everyone's happy and you don't want to leave, right? And so I firmly, firmly advise people that who you surround yourself with can turn you into a peasant or a rock star. Curate your companions wisely, because your well-being 100% depends on it. If you're surrounded by energy vampires, we're constantly complaining. Like if you're surrounded by 5 energy vampires, we're constantly complaining and bashing the situation and cursing their luck, you're going to be the 6th one. If you hang around with 5 entrepreneurs, I guarantee you, you're going to be the 6th one in no time, because they're all talking about business, talking about ideas. You know, there's this famous quote that says like, small-minded people talk about other people. Mediocre people talk about things like, oh, you know, I bought this car, this other thing. Great people think about ideas and impact, right? And so it's who you surround yourself with matters a ton. And the key realization of this was, you know, I often say I'm an accidental entrepreneur. Nobody in my family is an entrepreneur. They're all like brown, risk averse, Indian descent, go to university, right? Become an engineer or a doctor, one of the 2 paths, and then work yourself up for a long time at the same place and grow your career ladder. And then you'll retire at 65 with pension and you'll live a happy life. That is the definition. Provide for your family. Don't take any risks. When you see ruckus going on, put your head down and keep walking. If somebody slaps you, just turn around and keep walking, kind of thing. It's like risk averse to the freaking core, right? How did I become an entrepreneur? When I graduated university, I graduated engineering. So one of the funny things was I've always been a very rebellious kid, you know, studying last minute, trying to do things against society's norms. And I think the Gulf War experience exasperated that. I think put it on supercharge, put it on steroids. So nonetheless, I didn't finish high school. Okay. I ditched all my high school exams. I don't have a high school diploma. Now, most kids who don't have a high school diploma would never apply to university. I applied to every freaking university out there. Mm-hmm. And a couple of universities reached out to do this entrance exam. One university said, hey, we'll give you a conditional admission. Your entrance exams were good, but you got to send the transcripts or else within a month, we're going to unenroll you. But the semester is starting real soon, like next week. And, you know, we're just going to give you conditional acceptance. Now, luck would have it, they never followed up. So I graduated a bachelor's of engineering with software, bachelor of engineering and software without an undergraduate or without a high school diploma. So the lesson here, the moral is luck and risk are 2 sides of the same coin. The ones that get lucky are the ones that never stop flipping. Risk, 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 right? And so I was this rebellious kid. And when I graduated, I didn't want to do a 9-to-5. So I asked around, hey, if I wanted to be a business person someday, what's the best skill I could learn? And it kept coming up that a lot of what you do as an entrepreneur is communicate, negotiate, convince people, sell, right? Convincing your wife that, hey, I'm not going to bring money for a while. Convincing customers, buy my stuff and I barely have anything working. Convincing people to work for you on low pay. Convincing investors, media eventually, right? Is all communication. Now, I sucked as a communicator. And I said, listen, man, I'm not very self-motivated. Yeah. So if I Self-motivation is not hanging out on the beach of Dubai and showing up every single day, right? Self-motivation is when you're repeatedly punched in the face, will you turn up? Like the Rocky Balboa quote, it's not how hard you can hit, but it's how hard you get hit.
Keep moving forward.
Keep moving forward. Yeah, that's it, right? So self-motivation is that. And I knew I wasn't self-motivated. I feel 95% of the people are not very self-motivated, right? The first thing happens, especially this generation. I think the millennials, the Gen Zs, et cetera, because we're so mollycoddled, right? Like my parents weren't. My dad left home when he was 12, right? And before that, he was a farmer fending for the family alongside the rest of the brothers. I feel like the generations after more and more got mollycoddled by their parents. And so like, a lot of us are not self-motivated. So I said, if I show up to a communication or public speaking class, the first time 3 or 4 people laugh me off stage, I'm never showing up again. So I'm like, how do I fix this? I really want to go into business. My desire to not do a 9-to-5 was so high that I was willing to do anything. So I said, I started researching and I found that the only job that'll force me to communicate day in, day out was sales. So my first job at a university was cold calling for a telecom startup. I started applying sales jobs. Nobody would give me a sales job. This is 2005. They're like, why the hell you graduated engineering? You want a sales job? Like, you're not even qualified. Like, maybe you're crappy. You did crappy.
I'm sensing a pattern here, Lloyd. Doing things you're not qualified for, but continue.
So the pattern is like, probably you did bad in engineering. So now you want to switch to sales, but like, you know, I wouldn't get a job. Now, luck would have it that, you know, when you're a startup founder, you're desperate, you need people, you needed cold callers. I took that job. My Indian parents lose it. They're like, dude, your friends are working at Microsoft and Johnson & Johnson. What are you doing cold calling for near minimum wage? But fast forward today, I'm everything I am because of that one skill, right? Because I knew I didn't have the self-motivation to put myself through the ringer of public speaking. But if I got a job that forced me to communicate day in, day out, I'm like picking up the phone, dialing. My environment is a bunch of young cold callers. We're encouraging each other. You're then eventually with time, right? Like what they say is consistency leads to mastery. You just get better and better at communicating, pivoting your messaging on the fly. And that was the journey. But because I worked for a startup founder as my first job, when I started applying for another job, the only people who would hire me were founders. And the third job, only people who hire me are founders. So that happened where I was always surrounded by founders. And so when my best friend from university asked me to start Boast with him, I jumped at the opportunity because I understood the risk profile. I had done all of these tasks working alongside a founder. And so I think the net here is you become the average of the people you surround yourself with. If you hang out with 5 entrepreneurs, you will become the 6th one.
Yeah, 100%. Man, so much to that. And I love that pattern. I think it's super important too, just kind of like the lesson behind what I heard you sharing all those stories is the importance. I know you talk about in your book about the importance of connecting to purpose. You know, like the stories of our lives are so important to go back through and see what made you you. And it's really cool kind of like seeing the world that you ended up in with building community, how communication is so important that was a part of it, how having those early experiences of being a part of the war and organizing with other people helped to kind of build that sense of community and connection. So I know that's like a core tenet of what you do, but I think it's a valuable lesson for anyone is just to listen to that story and ask yourself, what are the stories that made me, and what are the patterns that I can continue to align with as far as my business strengths and kind of continue to do that. So you led us to the Boast AI. I want to talk about Pizza Nights and I want to, but there, before we get to the Pizza Nights, there's one other component of your backstory that you don't hear every day. So I'm intentionally going slow here because I want to hear about this because it's just super, super powerful. And I think really cements why you're so passionate about community. So people already heard that, you know, you grew up in the war and had to organize in community and, you know, sing on a bus together to kind of get through those situations. But you had another story I heard you share on a different podcast about some of your fondest memories as a child being spent in the slums of Mumbai. So I would love for you to maybe share a little bit about those summers and what you learned from those communal experiences growing up there.
Definitely. So my mom grew up in the slums of Mumbai and she wasn't educated. I think like maybe grade 9 or 10. My dad was a farmer, wasn't educated. And so back then, if you're not educated, you either get stuck in the rungs of India because you can't go out west, or you get a job in the Middle East, and a lot of people go to the Middle East because the currency converts significantly higher, right? And it's close in proximity. So my parents moved to Kuwait. My dad went from like dishwasher to celebrated executive chef, taught himself, self-taught chef kind of thing. But nonetheless, my mom didn't work because they had me pretty much a year after they got married. And she's like, okay, you know what? We can't afford nannies and stuff. So I'll just stay at home, look after him while you work kind of thing. And so we couldn't afford to have fancy vacations. So every summer, we just go back to India. And my childhood summer vacations every year were spent in the slums of Mumbai. Now, the interesting thing about that is my grandparents had 10 kids. My mom has 9 siblings. They all live in this small slum. And now added my dad, me there. And there's no toilet. So you got to line up, right, every day to go to the toilet, right? There's no water tank there, so you got to pump water, stand in line a couple times a day. It would rain every summer, so the puddles would turn into ponds and people would be swimming together. If you cook a little extra, you're sharing with your neighbor. My grandparents had a TV, I guess as a function of my parents living in Kuwait. So when you're watching TV now, it's also communal activity, right? Houses are facing each other. There's this little gully. I don't know how to say it. It's like a narrow freaking lane. And there's slums on either side. And you can peek into each other's houses. So if you're watching something interesting, people are hanging by your window railings to watch in. Everything from like going to the bathroom to pumping water to eating food to watching TV is a communal activity. And that was like my fondest childhood summers were spent there. Every summer when we had to go back to Kuwait, I'd grab my parents by the feet and cry. I didn't want to leave. And that just tells you the power of people in coming together, doing things together. The camaraderie just like puts you in such a positive mind frame that no matter what the challenge is, you don't even feel it's challenging, right? I'll give you a contrary example. You know, Napster back in the day, like, you know, it was illegal to download music. Everyone was doing it, right? It was illegal to download music, pirated music, but everyone was doing it. Why? Because if everyone is in it together, it's not a crime. Right. It's the same thing. If everyone is in a shitty situation together, the situation is not so shitty, right? If everyone is in a war zone together, yes, it's bad, but the feeling of the togetherness overcome some of the bad, right? If everyone is piss poor together, hanging in the slums, but they're playing together, they're eating together, they're singing together, it's not so bad, right? You make the most of the situation you're in.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love that story so much. And it's so cool. Again, I said this before, I'll say it again. It's so cool that you went back to your roots and you built a career and you built a life around the meaningful experience that you had as a kid of like creating that for other people. I saw that you wrote in your book, your purpose is to bring people together to create impact and joy. And that's just so cool that you're able to kind of take those core elements that really sparked your imagination, sparked your bonding, that made you want to cry from leaving those experiences as a kid into what you're doing today. So I want to kind of maybe bridge the gap between those stories and the community and the intentionality that you bring to helping people build community. So I think a great place to start would be talking a little bit. Maybe we can kind of blend two things together, because I know you have this incredible journey of starting Pizza Nights that turned into this incredible Boast scaling that you did, but community-led growth. So I think maybe if you can maybe talk a little bit about those Pizza Nights and why community-led growth is something that you're so passionate about, that you believe in, and why you decided to write a book about it.
Yeah, you know, so fast forward a few more years, you started Boast. It, for whatever it's worth, you know, when you try something new, you defer to your experience, right? Your experience, my experience was sales, sales, sales. But when you're pushed up against the wall, your reflexes kick in. My reflex was community. When I picked up the phone, first few weeks of Boast, it was very hard getting anyone to meet us, right? The volume was not converting. We started trying to sell, go to events, like it just wasn't working. And so my natural reflex was community, and that kicked in. And you know, that's the long story short, is we end up building a community-led business. And when we got to 10 million ARR, we had no marketing team. There was no marketing. It was community-led combined with salespeople, and our salespeople were more like community managers, but we called them business development, that would go out, meet people, understand their pain points, and like, hey, you may need this other thing and I'll connect you. It was all partnerships done in the community, helping each other out. That was the ethos upon which the company was built, a true community-led business. Now, when we sold half the company, you know, it's funny, all my life didn't have money. And then my wife's a doctor. But when we started the company, she was a resident making like, I think $45,000 or so. Eventually started making good money. So she supported us through that journey, supported me through the journey. My co-founder's wife is a lawyer. She supported him through the journey. And then eventually the company started making money. We started doing better and better, but nonetheless, like nothing to write home about. Then eventually in 2020, November or so, October, November, we sold 52% of the company to a growth equity firm, right? And me and my co-founder transitioned to the board probably within a year after that. And I was the first to transition out. Honestly, like, that should have been my happiest time. But when I left the day-to-day of my business, I actually hit rock bottom. I just couldn't figure out. I felt like I lost my tribe. I lost the people. I lost the community. I lost everything. And the money didn't matter. And I was moping. And, you know, I started doing crazy things. Like, I started calling different people I knew and just show up in their city. And because that come in with some money, I'm like, oh, let's party, or I'll fly you here. Like, I went to Dominican Republic, and I went to Romania. And we have a team in Romania. I went like everywhere, pretty much, I could go, right? I was just like flying, partying, hanging out with people. I felt like I needed to, you know, because I lost my tribe, which was a company, I felt like I was going to lose the community I'd built, the traction community. So I started hitting up different people and flying everywhere. And I think shit hit the fan when I'm now in Romania at a conference speaking there. And we're at the speaker after party, speaker retreat. And we're by the pool, I think 4 hours away from Bucharest in the wilderness. And at 2 a.m, I'm frantically dialing, you know, trying to call for an Uber. And the guys, the organizers are like, you know, other speakers, like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm calling for an Uber. They're like, why? You're not going to get anyone at this hour. So I left that going. I asked the hotel if they could get me a car. And they're like, not at this hour. So the Uber kept spinning. 20 minutes later, it goes ding, and Uber's on the way. I waited. Uber shows up. I tell them, hey, can you wait? I wasn't sure you're going to make it. I bring my laptop. I pop it up. I book a flight to Costa Rica. I get in the car. My bags were packed. And I'm like, guys, I'm heading to Costa Rica. I have some friends hanging out there. They called me, and I'm just going to take the next flight. The next flight was at 7:30 in the morning. It took like, I think, 3.5-4 hours to get to Bucharest airport, and I barely made the flight. That's how crazy I got. Like, I just felt like anyone who called me to an event, a party, a get-together, no matter where it was, I needed to make that, or else, like, I was going to lose my tribe. That's how crazy I went. And then when I got home, now I'm like overweight, I'm drinking all the time, partying every weekend. My wife's like, she's like, look at you, man. Like, you know, we let you mope. We understand. But you don't appreciate that the glass is always half full, right? You're in a situation that anyone would kill to be in, but you choose to mope about what you don't have. Your first community is your family. If you destroy your health and something happens to you, your wife and 3 kids are going to be left holding the bag. And that was a huge wake-up call for me. And she's like, you might not get a third chance. So what happened was, you know, the universe is always trying to tell you something, right? Because if everything is perfect, then that's not life, right? Maybe it's a video game, not even a video game, because even in the video game, it's not perfect. So nonetheless, all my life, I chased this definition of success, which is money. The deal went through, the wire hit my bank. I said, well, book everyone to Bora Bora, but the Bora Bora trip never happened. I got hospitalized for COVID, bilateral COVID pneumonia, and almost died of COVID. And then after that, I transitioned out of the day-to-day, like probably within like 10 months or so, right? But it was like hard. The company grew. I think we like 4x the size of the company, all kinds of chaos, you know, how a company grows after a fundraise. And then I left the day-to-day. And so she's like, listen, you almost died of COVID. and you still won't take this signal and you're still going hard, you might not get a third chance. And so it, as I was reflecting, right, and I'm sitting here, I'm like, okay, you know, what she says is right. You know, I've neglected my family for the most, for the business first, and now like whatever effed up definition of success I have and what I've lost, I'm like literally destroying myself. And in the corner of my room, I see this Peloton bike, okay? I hop on it. I'm like, okay, you know what? Maybe I'll hop on the bike, right? Let's hop on the Peloton. I switch it on and I just randomly pick up an instructor. Her name now, she's famous, Robin Arzon. She was coming off maternity leave and she's like, hey, I don't feel as strong. You know, I'm feeling weak. I can't ride as I used to. And then she yells out like, self-pity is toxic. You don't need that shit. One crank, one shift, one rider of around the block. I am, I can, repeat after me. So I kept going and that 20 minute hit ride flew in 2 minutes. And that one ride turned into two, into three. And then started making friends with more fit people, added the gym. My morning ritual started turned into like, hey, be thankful for the glass that's half full when you wake up, something good that happened the previous day, person, an event, bang out 50 push-ups to the Eye of the Tiger from Rocky, because that was the music that was playing on that first ride, and then hit the gym, right? Like all of these things started becoming a part of my life. And I realized, man, in my toughest times, nothing felt tough ever, ever. It never felt like, oh, I'm miserable. There's some misery. Honestly, a lot of people tell me like, oh, you've had some tough times. I'm like, where? Like, this is just part of life, because I was surrounded by a community of people, whether it's the slums of Mumbai, whether it's the Gulf War, whether it's the community which we built Traction. And the only time I was down when I didn't have a community, and then eventually what brought me back to good health and sanity was also community. And I said, I have to now in my spare time, if I'm going to sit here and do nothing, the least I can do is educate the world on the power of community. And then one of the key researches I found also was Blue Zones, right? I don't know, have you heard of Blue Zones?
Yeah.
The 5-6 places around the world where people live functionally until 100, and functionality matters a lot in longevity. Otherwise, it's meaningless. And I think 4 or 5 out of their 9 traits that make them tick is these communal activities, working out together, walking together, eating together, belonging to a community, belonging to a spiritual belief kind of thing. And so that solidified it. And I had to write the book and then started talking to lots and lots and lots of people, looking at the guts or looking, trying to find behind the scenes of how some of the most enduring brands came to be. And this is not like the tech companies that started in the 2000s, right? Because who knows if they'll endure over time, but the companies that have stood the test of time from the 80s, the 70s, right? And I found something very interesting. Every obscure idea that eventually became an enduring global phenomena, from Christ to CrossFit, went through the exact same 4 stages. People listen to you or buy your product, you have an audience. When you bring that audience to connect with one another on a cadence, it turns into a community. When that community comes together to create impact towards a purpose far greater than your profit or product, it becomes a movement. And when that movement has undying faith in its purpose through sustained rituals, over time, it becomes a cult or a religion. So audience, community, movement, religion. A lot of influencers today, they all have audiences. If people comment on your post, that's not a community. That's maybe audience plus. But when you start bringing people together on a cadence and they start coming together without you in the room around the purpose, magic eventually happens, man.
Man, so good. Thank you for leading us right here. So let's deconstruct some of this stuff about how people can intentionally build communities. Because I don't think we probably connected on this the first time we talked, Lloyd, but I believe my purpose is to create a more deeply connected world. And this like insight to me that community builders and me investing in learning how to build community is by far the greatest lever I can pull to create a more deeply connected world. And so I'm just grateful for you and the fact that you did the deep dive on all the elements of community. And so we'll see how much we can share, because this is really meaningful for me. And I know this is so important for everyone, especially having come through COVID. People are craving for this stuff more than ever. And so there's so many different places we can start, but I think a good place to start would actually be with the different types of community. So if you wouldn't mind maybe sharing just categorically the different types, then I think Camper would probably be a really great next step. But yeah, why don't you just start by sharing what are the different types of community? If we're thinking about building one, whether it's for our business or our personal lives, how can we begin to start thinking about the different ways to build community?
Definitely. First, you know, I think before you start any kind of community, and we can go there, but like, it's start with who you're serving, right? And yep. Even before that, start with your values. A lot of people want to start community, and then I ask them, like, why are you in it? Why are you doing it? What's your purpose, right? What's your why? What's the vision? What's the mission? What are your values? And then the next thing they ask me is like, oh, when can I monetize? How will I make money? And I'm like, listen, if you don't have the DNA of giving, passion drives everything, right? Like when I say passion, meaning if you hate your customers or hate the task you're doing, yes, you'll power through it. A lot of it is powering through crap you don't like in the early days. But if once money comes in, right? So money doesn't change people. Money just brings out the real you. When yep. money comes in, you'll not want to do it anymore. You'll abandon it, right? Building a community or a community-led business is a marathon of the heart and mind. It's a long freaking slog. If you don't have the DNA of giving and helping people without expecting anything in return, you don't believe in the concept of karma that comes back, you'll power through it in the early days. Then you'll start making some money, and then you'll abandon it because you actually hate it, right? Mm. Or it's not part of you. So the first thing is alignment on values. And alignment on the purpose. The next thing is figuring out who your ideal customer or community profile is, who you're trying to serve. It's better to be an inch wide and a mile deep than like a mile wide and serve everyone in an inch deep. What is the problem you're solving for them? Or what is the gain you're trying to create for them that is a 10Xer, that is serving a white space versus being the 100 sales community and so on? So like niche down, can you niche down and down and down? A lot of people want to start with a big TAM, but you know, if you niche down, you can connect with people. It's like saying, I invite you to my house, and then you come in and you see like butchers, bakers, candlestick makers, and you can't connect with anyone. And you gotta, when you open the door, you don't find anyone to greet you. You have to swim through garbage kind of thing to get there. Now I invite you to my house and I open the door and I'm like, hey, Brandon, you know, great to have you here. Let me pour you a drink. You walk in, you meet people in your same industry or people like, you know, belong to similar interests. Like let's assume you're a startup founder. You come over, I pour you a glass of wine from Napa. We're in Silicon Valley. You see like a bunch of startup folks that you want to learn from. You see like TechCrunch there. You see other vendors you buy from. All of a sudden you're like, dude, I can sit here all day long. These are the people I want to hang out with, right? So I think it's very important to niche down. And a lot of people, they get afraid to niche down. They're like, no, we want to start with a bigger niche, right? But how can you try to please 10 people?
Yeah.
So when we started Boast, we didn't go after all business. We went after tech businesses. Now, we did not go after all tech businesses. We went after startups. This was 2012. We didn't go after all startups. We started with startups in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And then we found two white spaces. One is nobody gives startups love over there in the media. And then all the content is high-level aspirational talks at the events. Nobody's talking about how I got my first 10 customers or how I got my first angel investment back then in 2012. So because of those two white spaces, you'll find those white spaces when you niche down, right? Then you can deliver that value, and then showing up consistently will build that affinity. So
there's so much I want to zoom in on. So I'm going to zoom in on here, and then we can kind of zoom in on the other stuff. This is so, so valuable. Like hit that back skip button like a few times and re-listen to that. Like these are the things that Lloyd is talking about here are like, you know, it's step one to figure out your purpose and your core values and your vision, right? But like that is a whole freaking journey. So like take a second and really just think about that kind of stuff. And I would encourage anyone to go check out episode 140A if you're interested in that. That was me deconstructing all those, asking those big questions. Who am I? What are my superpowers? You know, what are my values? What's my purpose? All that kind of stuff. And you can obviously go check out Lloyd's book if you want a deep dive on that as well. He's got some incredible frameworks. But I want to zoom in on this spot that you just brought us to about finding your people, because I had highlighted this from your book. You had talked about one of the biggest, most dangerous obstacles you see in these early stages is impatience of trying to grow too fast and not really getting to know those people that you really want to zoom in on. So maybe I think this is a huge thing that I'm thinking about too, is I'm in the early stages of building my mastermind Curiosity Island. It's you can keep trying to figure out growing and adding more people, but the value of actually really going deep with people and figuring out how you can add value is really critical. So maybe if you wouldn't mind zooming in on that one component of the early stages of a business, you have those first 5, 10, 20 people, and the desire to grow and continue adding people is great, but you found that many people stumble of not really zooming in on here. So if somebody's at those stages, if they've done the work, if they started bringing people together, what are some of the things that you would recommend people do to make sure that you're really honing in on serving that one group of people that is so important to you?
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of people, I'll give you an example. A lot of people are impatient. And I think this comes more from the nurture and how we're brought up, right? A lot of us are praised and reprimanded based on results, right? You got good grades. Fantastic. You didn't get good grades. You suck. And what happens is when you're praised and reprimanded as a kid growing up based on results, then you start to develop some risk averseness, right? If you see signs of something's not working out, you don't want to do it. You think it's going to fail and you'd rather not be a failure. And I think more people need to appreciate the effort and the process, because ultimately, if you keep following the process and show up consistently, the score takes care of itself, right? Life is not... it's a journey. It's a marathon. It's not one episode or one contest kind of thing. And so I think one of the key things is to realize that building a business, even a community-led business, any kind of business, is a marathon. It genuinely is. It's not buying a lottery ticket. It is genuinely a marathon. And it's a long freaking slog. And you better brace yourself for the long slog or not do it at all. You may fail a million times in that long slog. And, you might see certain glimmers of hope that you may take, and it leads you to a successful path. But that may be short-lived just until the next turn. And then you see another obstacle. This is the marathon of a business. This is the marathon of life. It's not perfect. And if you're looking for immediate results, especially in building a community, you may as well not do it, right? Building a business is hard enough. Building a community-led business is harder, but it's a ticket to building a sustainable enterprise that is low cost in terms of customer acquisition. It can be a lever for customer acquisition, customer feedback, a brand builder, social proof, everything. So if you're looking for immediate results, it doesn't happen. It's like saying the other thing that takes a long time is SEO. It's like, I started today. Can I see results? Can I rank to the top of Google tomorrow? No, it doesn't work that way, right? If you're genuinely looking and you're desperate for instant results, pick up the phone and cold call. Figure out a product-led growth version of your offering and push it out. Spam people via email, run ads, do direct response. Basically, what I'm saying is get really good at direct response, because that'll give you immediate results. Building a community is a long haul and you have to brace yourself. The only way to get there is through patience. Compound interest on consistency is what we call overnight success. Look at Mr. Beast, right? He's one of the greatest, icons in the influencer community. Look at his first videos. How long did it take? It sucked. Glimmers of hope. And now he's crushing it. And he's the biggest, right? Consistency is the secret ingredient that turns small actions into big outcomes. And if you cannot understand this, don't get into business. Don't get into community. Just get a 9-to-5 job, because every 2 weeks you get the you get the, I guess, dopamine of a paycheck.
Yeah, no, and I would say too, I love that you can, it's like, if you're not down for this, go learn some direct response stuff. Not that direct, I love direct response. There's so much that you can learn from it, but and I'm sure this, like, your experience lines up with this, is that the lifetime value of a customer that comes through from a community-based model versus a conversion on a sales page that doesn't really know the other people is going to be dramatically different. So I love that you brought up the fact that, like, it is a long-term play, but the value is definitely going to be there for so many different metrics in your business, nonetheless, making it even a more fulfilling and deeply meaningful experience. So since we're talking about slowing down, let's like slow down here, because I love how in your book, you talk about, many of us have heard about your ICP, your ideal customer profile, but you talk about your ideal community persona. So we'd love for you to talk a little bit more about that side of, if we're slowing down, if we really want to make sure that we're adding value to these people, how can we be intentional about that community persona and building out systems and experiences that really serve that people so that we can get the data to grow in the long term?
Definitely. So I think, you know, the first step is coming up with your ideal community persona. I'll say this with an example. So when we started Boast, right, I started cold calling construction, oil and gas, manufacturing. I'm like, okay, we need to get customers. Who are the customers that pay? Well, established companies, construction, oil and gas, manufacturing. Let's hit them up. Nobody would talk to us, man. So dejected, we're like, okay, let's go to some of the events these guys host. We felt like fish out of water. We look like two guys who threw on a suit jacket on top of a hoodie, and they look like the Cigars Club. We couldn't resonate. So dejected, we started going to the new business, the startup events, and we felt like we instantly found our tribe. A lot of, you know, if you start serving and scratching your own itch, sometimes you can build, a lot of the times you can build a successful business or a community. Because if you have this problem, I'm sure others do as well. So we started going to other to startup events, and we felt like we connected with our tribe. We found our tribe. We were eating, hanging out, breathing, drinking in the same places, hosting events together, participating in hackathons together. And through the time we started hanging out with these startup founders, we got to know them so well because they had the same pains we did. And inadvertently, we talked to hundreds of founders, and we found the white space. Like, basically, summarize to, where do they eat, breathe, drink, sleep? What are their pains and goals? Now, pains and goals are short-lived. What are their aspirations as well? Because pains and goals may give you product 1 and 2. Their long-term aspirations will give you product 3 and 4. And then what stands in the way of their pains and goals? And understanding that, I think, is very key. And think to yourself, hey, man, if I had to someday write a book or the ultimate guide to XYZ for this ICP, what would be the chapters, the sub-chapters, the tactical advice, the key takeaways in there? So think about it from that perspective. Then your next phase is mapping out their circle of influence. So number one, who do they follow? Who are the influencers that would be relevant to them that, you know, if you invited that influencer on your podcast or as a speaker to your event, their social proof would create social proof for you with your ideal community profile, right? With your community members. The next is, who do they fund? What are the tools and services they pay for? Because you could partner with them, make a list of those. You could partner with them to distribute content, to co-host events, bring them on as sponsors. And the last one is, where are they... who do they fund? Who do they follow? And where do they frequent? What platforms, what blogs, what magazines? All of this is key. Where do they frequent is key, because if your ideal customer profile frequents TikTok and has no clue about LinkedIn, why are you on LinkedIn? Or if your ideal customer profile hangs out at the Rotary Club, why are you on Instagram if they're a bunch of 60, 70-year-olds? So that's what you got to deeply think about. Like, where do they frequent? So you know where to distribute your content. Who do they fund? What are the tools they pay for? So you could bring the right partners. It's almost like Instagram has this collaborator mode, right? Like, two people collaborate to produce something and you get the benefit of both audiences. Finding people they fund are people that you can collaborate with, will give you access to the similar audience you're looking for. And it grows both your audiences, right? And then the who do they follow, you get the social proof of the influencer relevant to that space. And then it's important, once you nail all of this down, it's important to figure out the kind of community you want to build, right? And that's the question you asked, and I went down this this journey of how to get there, right? It's like, understand your ICP, understand your values, understand the circle of influence around your ICP, and then figure out the kind of community you want to build. There's one of three kinds of communities you can build. A community of product is everything about your product, right? Like, how do you use it? How do you build on top of it? How do you get better of it? Better at it, like the Microsoft community or the Atlassian community. The thing though is, if you don't have a product that's frequently used in people's day-to-day, or you're a new product that nobody knows about and you barely have any customers, if you build a community of product, people will think you're trying to sell to them, right? And they don't want to be a part of it. The next one is a community of practice, bringing people together to get better at a specific skill or a craft, like what you're doing with Beyond Curious, right? You're building a community for community builders. Or what we did with Traction is building a community for tech founders in the startup space, initially in Canada, right? And now it's become fairly global, but our initial heart of the audience was Canada. And the last one is a community of play, which is bringing people together to have fun, like the Nike Running Club or the Harley Davidson Weekend Warriors community kind of thing, CrossFit. If you don't have a product that's frequently used or a product with any customers, start with the community of practice and maybe incorporate some elements of play, because I think play it just engages people for the long haul, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the route I would take.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, so this has just been a pure masterclass. So I'm taking notes for you guys listening right now. We have communities of practice where you're learning together. And so where you're learning together, you got communities of product, and then you have communities of play. And I love that so much. So let's think about, like, I came from a background in accelerated learning and memory, right? So I'll kind of give you people like a recap of where we've been, just so I can keep it straight in my head. We talked about finding your purpose, finding that vision, figuring out the why behind all this kind of stuff. And then we talked about how you can really zoom in on that ICP, the ideal community persona, and think about the different ways that they are looking to be served, right? Where are they hanging out? What are their key jobs? What are they funding? Where are they following? Who are they frequenting? And then from there, you can kind of reverse engineer and determine if you want a community of practice, a community of product, or a community of play. So I know we're kind of coming up on time, Lloyd, and this has already been just a masterclass, but there's one other framework that I think would be valuable to kind of add in here, and that is your camper framework. So would you mind sharing about that if we got to this point in community and who we want to serve?
Definitely. So, you know, when we talk about values, right, remember I said start with understanding your values. As I looked at hundreds and hundreds of companies that sustained over time, there were six elements that are very common, core to their values. Just, they had many values, but these elements were core. One is connection, bringing people together to connect with one another. Everyone craves connection, right? If you join a workforce or any community and there's no connection, you're going to fade. The next one is autonomy. Nobody wants to be micromanaged. If I'm standing by the side of your ear and like barking orders all day, you're going to be disengaged. Third one is mastery. I want to get better and better at my craft. Nobody wants to do the same thing all day long. Nobody wants to be typecast. If I join as maybe, let's say, I joined the HubSpot. Like, I learned a lot about marketing from HubSpot as an engineer in my early days. HubSpot had the inbound marketing community. Now, if I joined as a novice marketer and I stayed there, then there's no mastery. I'll get disengaged. But I got better and better and better. That's why I stay engaged with HubSpot's content, right? So mastery. The fourth one is purpose. And we talked about this earlier, is that, you know, great leaders, great community leaders, great company leaders, they cascade purpose, not just goals. And when you cascade purpose, that it hits the lowest common denominator in the company, you know you have something that's going to last. I think an urban legend references the President Kennedy was walking the halls of NASA, and at midnight, he sees the janitor sweeping the room, and he's like, "Hey, what are you doing at this hour?" And the janitor says, "Sir, I'm putting a man on the moon." That is great purpose, where everyone knows that they're part of a greater purpose and they have a valuable part in driving that. They're not a cog right? They are a key component of the machine. So you drive that purpose. The fifth one is energy, right? Like the Red Bull energy drink. Think about it. You go to a conference and everything is going great. You're having a fantastic time. And then a speaker comes in and throws on a PowerPoint and is just reading off the PowerPoint. Sucks the energy dry. People start getting disengaged, looking in their phones, popping their laptop, whispering to each other, leave the room. You can visualize this. Energy 100% is key to building a sustainable community. Look at Gandhi, look at Martin Luther King, some of the greatest communities that turned into movements and eventually cults or religions had energy as a key component of it. And the last one is recognition. One thing we don't do very well, and I think immigrants, right, from Asian, Indian heritages, they're really bad at it, is proactively recognizing, and I can say this because I'm from Indian heritage, like proactively recognizing, we wait to reward or reprimand the results at work and with our kids. But we don't appreciate people for the little that they do day in, day out. If you keep appreciating people for no matter what small or big they do, they want to show up for more, man. People are not robots, right? They don't like, okay, you know what? You're doing your job, so I'm giving you a paycheck. And then if you go above and beyond, I'll give you like a medal. No, you did something good today. Like everyone has a tendency to do something good, right? Just be thankful. Just be thankful, appreciate the little that they do, and they'll do more. I'm telling you this, like, you know, I think a lot of people view this as vanity. Like, oh, you know, people just should just suck it up and do it. I understand people should suck it up and do it. Most don't. So what is the psychological antidote to this? Appreciate them more. Mm-hmm. If somebody is trying to get fit and you keep, you know, has to show up every day, you're overweight and you keep working out, nobody's complimenting you. Eventually, you're just going to like, you're like, oh man, this is hard. And like, maybe it's not worth it. Like you mentally like psych out, right? But if five people come to you and be like, hey man, you look like you lost some weight. You're looking great. What are you doing? You're like, it's instant encouragement, right? Recognize people proactively. So connection, autonomy, mastery, purpose, energy, recognition. Incorporate that in your relationship, in your business, in your community, and things will change. Look at your relationship with your spouse, right? You want to feel connected. You don't want to micromanage each other, especially when spouses micromanage each other. Man, it like, at least workplace has workplace professionalism. All professionalism goes out the door when you've been dating or married for a long time, right? Mastery, help each other get better and better. You're filling each other's gap. Purpose, there's a greater purpose here. What is your purpose as a couple, as a family? Energize each other, infuse romance, like infuse energy into your relationship. Don't wait for the one Valentine's Day and the one birthday to bring flowers or appreciate people. Do that. And the best way to show appreciation for your spouse is probably take a little bit of the load, right? And and give a little thank you. Try this in the relationship, man. It just, trust me, it gets better.
100%. I love when you, I mean, it's very clear that you've done your work to make sure that this is first principle stuff, because it's like when you find the first principle stuff, it applies everywhere. So I love that camper is applicable in community. It's relevant for your home life. It's relevant for so much. So I love that. And I have like a selfish question to ask that intersects between the types of community and mastery, what you just shared before. So, because, I mean, this is kind of tying together a bunch of different insights, but this just occurred to me. So it's like, if you've gone deep on your ICP, and for my context, it's like, I'm launching this Curiosity Island mastermind. I'm serving beyond curious, deep connection focused community builders, entrepreneurs that are changing the world with their communities and their ideas. And so one of the things that I've realized in studying and working with these people is that they're all passionate about building a business that's in 100% alignment with who they are and how they show up in the world. And it's less about addition. It's more about subtraction. How do I remove the things that aren't aligned, and how do I build that way? So when it comes to somebody that has gone deep on their ICP and they're looking at creating a community of practice where people are learning together and mastering together, one of the things that I feel like I've arrived at and just hearing you talk is like, okay, one of the things that should be a important forefront thing about my community of practice is the constraints around how we are learning and the constraints around why we want to build a certain way we want to build. So is it important to think about like setting up the container of what success means in a particular context when you've chosen communities of practice? It's kind of a messy question, but I'm basically just saying I've arrived at this point where it's like, I think the alignment or the thing that is between all these people is they all want to build a business in alignment with who they are, their most natural gifts, delegate the stuff that doesn't work and remove the things that don't fit. So like, do you encourage people to really set those constraints around what mastery means when they're setting up a community of practice?
You know, constraints lead to creativity, right? And I think having constraints is really important. Nothing should feel like a never-ending science project. Think about it, right? If it's like you can do it on your time, whenever, however, no constraints, then there's no accountability. I think when you have constraints, you develop this accountability. You need to have, of course, a purpose. Each person, I think every individual needs to have, what is my purpose? What is my vision? What are my values? How am I going to do it? What are my obstacles? What are my goals, right? And the time frame is really important. I'm a firm believer in to expedite. The only way to expedite learning is to have constrained environments, right? When I say not constrained in the information or the learning provided to you, but constrained in terms of the time or the activity, right? So you yeah. need to accomplish a certain goal within a certain time frame. Like cohort-based learning is perfect for it. But giving people actual objectives that are immediately applicable that they need to drive versus saying, you know what? It doesn't matter. If it's not accountable, if it's not immediately relevant to me and I can do it at some point at some time, and I'm not seeing results, right? Then why would I stick with it? Then it becomes like a, it doesn't become a must have. And I think constraints, figuring out the right constraints to make something must have is key. Constraints help you make something must have from like a nice to have or a need to have.
I love that. So that's a huge takeaway for me is just thinking about like, if you have chosen a community of practice and you are learning together, what are the rules of the game on what success looks like if you're coming together and you're coming to practice? Cause growing for scaling and growth sake versus growing for impact is two different things. And maybe there's two different groups of people that are interested in that. So those constraints are super important. So man, Lloyd, this has been such a masterclass. It's been such a journey of hearing how community shaped your life and the different ways that it's impacted you and all the highs and all the lows. So I want to be respectful of your time. I know we're kind of coming up here. So I would love to kind of ask towards the end when I get the opportunity to ask guests, how has curiosity impacted your life? If you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about how your curiosity has served you in your journey.
You know, I love kids because they're naive and they're curious. And that's why every project I want to take on, I want to take on in an industry I know nothing about, because I'll be naive and curious, right? The only way to consistently grow is to be naive and curious. Naive because if you know everything about something, then you have preconceived notions or you feel like you know better than everyone else. I love to be the dumbest person in the room. And that's why, you know, the circle I'm in constantly changes over time. Like I have my very close set of besties, brothers, family members, but I hop between different circles because I don't want to ever be the smartest person in the room ever. I want to constantly be learning. And so, you know, I'll share this. The role of a founder and a CEO are two different roles, right? They're at loggerheads with each other. A founder's job is to consistently inject new risk in the business, and the CEO's job is to stabilize the business. And so my co-founder and I shared that responsibility. He was the CEO, I was the president. But a lot of what I did to stay interested in the business was take on new projects, figure out the SDR, figure out the community, figure out, you know, SF as a market, figure out Toronto as a market, every time try something new. And so my life just felt like I'm going from one project to the other. Oh, launch the Traction Conference. Oh, launch the Toronto market. In a constrained, condensed amount of time, do a project. Then the book was the same thing. Make it a bestseller, constrained, condensed amount of time. Did 100 podcasts and begged everyone to launch it on the same week as my Butch launch kind of thing. Now I'm helping my wife through her transformation journey. Is a 150-day transformation journey, and we're day 92. And at the end of 150 days, I'm launching a new podcast called Unicorn Porn with my good friend Melissa Kwan, and we're making fun of the absurdities of the startup world while going through tactical advice on building success in business without confining to society's norms. So, you know, for me, I like to live in those short bursts of project phases, and I feel like that keeps things interesting.
Yeah, 100%. And as you're sharing your story about, like, it's so apparent that that's been the pattern. It will continue to be the pattern, whether it's, you know, not knowing engineer, making your way into college without having a high school degree and being the noob there, and then having engineering and saying, fuck it, I'm going to go do cold calling, you know, being the noob in the room is your MO. And it seems like that's just been the catalyst for growth of you, is making sure you're putting yourself in those environments to grow and continue chase that inner itch, that inner curiosity. So I love that so much. Well, Lloyd, the last question I love, that's the simplest, is where can people find out more about you? Obviously, everybody can go grab From Grassroots to Greatness. We'll have that linked up in the show notes. But where can people find out about you and all the other incredible stuff that you're up to, my friend?
Definitely. Yeah. So the one thing I'll add to that is the only thing constant is change, and pain is the precondition for growth. That's why people do ice baths and saunas and everything to put their bodies. And I go one step further, like 15 years in San Francisco and now moved to Dubai on a whim kind of thing. I think it grows your mind in many ways, but you can find me. I used to write a lot on LinkedIn. I've taken a LinkedIn sabbatical. We'll come back on LinkedIn sometime mid, late April, but I'm on Instagram a lot these days, documenting a transformation journey, talking business, fitness, intentional living, Lloyd Lobo. And then my book's on lloydlobo.com, or just find it on Amazon.
Love that. Amazing. Well, I'm just going to really quickly have a conversation with you listening, my friend. I just want to say, you could be listening to any other podcast. You could be doing so many other things. But if you're still listening to my voice right now, that means that you have hung on for one hell of a journey. And the reason why podcasts are so important to me is because I know that every single episode contains something that can completely transform someone's life. My life has absolutely been changed by the content that I've heard. And Lloyd's has packed in so much value and shared so many powerful stories. So I just want you to think for a second about this journey that we've been on, and think of one person that might find value in this. Maybe it was hearing that story earlier on of Lloyd being on Highway 80, literally called the Highway of Death, with burned vehicles all over the place, and in that bus singing and being surrounded by community, or his fond memories as a child being like surrounded by community, or his recovery, like so much stories. But maybe we got into like the tactical stuff. Maybe it was something he shared about building that ideal community persona, or the different types of communities, or camper. Like, this was chock full. This was amazing. And so my ask is that you just share this with one person. You have no idea the impact that it could create on the life if you just take a second to do that. So whether you choose to do that or not, I appreciate you so much for being here. And Lloyd, any final things you want to say before we head off today, my friend?
That's it, man. If you build a community, you will not become a commodity. Yesterday's innovation always becomes tomorrow's commodity, but if you build a community, you won't become a commodity.
Mic drop. Awesome. Appreciate it, brother, and we'll talk to you very soon.
Awesome, man. This was great.